There's an Australian story about a one-eyed man wandering through the desert who, before he stretches out on his swag and goes to sleep, takes out his glass eye and puts it on a nearby tree stump. But in the morning, when he wakes, his eye has gone. Who can have taken it? The bushwhacker, being wise to the ways of the wild, knows that there can only be one explanation. He walks off into the bush nearby, looks around, and eventually finds an extraordinary construction beside a nearby rock, two parallel walls of twigs a couple of feet long and about a foot apart. At one end, there is a pile of white objects, quartz pebbles, bits of bleached bone, and some snail shells. And there, in the middle of them, staring balefully up at him, his glass eye. The thief, if that's what you want to call him, was a male bowerbird. And his walls of twigs were not a nest. They were a kind of structure that is unique in the animal kingdom, a sort of showcase, a bower. A male bowerbird spends the bulk of his time working on it, either building the walls or collecting fresh treasures to put in front of it, and all to impress the females. They, at the beginning of the breeding season, tour all the bowers in the district. Every time a female appears nearby, the male goes into paroxysms of strutting and shrieking, calling attention to his collection. But the females are very choosy. If one is sufficiently impressed, she moves into the bower, and the two may mate there, or in some species, flutter off together into the nearby bush. Then away she goes, back to the nest that she has built for herself and entirely by herself. There, unaided by him in any way, she will rear her chicks. He, meanwhile, continues doing what he can to add to his treasures and the splendours of his bower, and hopes that his luck will continue. He's quite pernickety. The bird that took the glass eye was probably a great bower bird, because that species prefers white objects. Other bower bird species have other tastes. The satin bower bird, which lives in somewhat better vegetated parts of eastern Australia, has a passion for blue. It's probably not a coincidence that he himself has glossy blue plumage and a glittering blue eye. It's as though the blue things he collects for his bower, blue berries, even bits of blue plastic if he lives near human habitation, become extensions of his own body. Certainly, they seem to have the same effect as the extravagant plumes and decorations that are developed each breeding season by birds such as pheasants, ducks, and birds of paradise. But in fact, his objects are rather more convenient than feathers because he doesn't have to grow them afresh every year, nor does he have to carry them around with him all the time. On the other hand, no male bowerbird is happy to leave his bower for long. He has competitors. If he is away, there's always the danger that one of his neighbours will nip in and steal some of his painstakingly assembled treasures. Worse, one might come and actually vandalise his bower, tearing down the twig walls with his beak so as to reduce the competition. Avenue-shaped bowers are not the only kind built by these amazing birds. Away to the north, in the great island of New Guinea, there are even more species than there are in Australia. A dozen of them, and the bowers they build are perhaps even more extraordinary. The first Europeans to see the constructions of McGregor's bowerbird in the thick, humid, tangled rainforest can only imagine that it was the work of local people, something to do, perhaps, with their bizarre rituals. It consists of a sapling around which is constructed a tower of interwoven twigs that may be 4 or 5 feet high. Around the base, even more remarkably, there's a kind of circular runway, the outer wall of which has a smooth, rounded top made of specially planted moss, decorated with little bits of evenly spaced black fungus like raisins. And there are treasures here, too. They're not quite as obviously attractive as the white pebbles or blue plastic of the Australian species, but something more arcane that can only appeal to a really sophisticated taste. Frass. Caterpillar droppings. He collects them from the forest and attaches them to the ends of the twigs of his tower. When a female comes by, he hides. If she alights on the wall of the runway, he will scuttle around to the other side so that he is hidden behind the tower and start to sing. She cocks her head, listening, and he peeps out to see how she's reacting. If she thinks well of it, she will hop down into the runway. That is a very good sign indeed, and he whizzes round and executes an excited strutting dance before the pair fly off into the bushes. But even this maypole-like tower is not the most elaborate of bowerbird constructions. To find that, you have to go to the western end of New Guinea, known because of its shape on the map as the Vogelkopf, the bird's head. The bowers built by the Vogelkopf bowerbird is, to my mind, one of the most extraordinary sights in all nature. Its core is a tower of twigs built around a sapling like a maypole bower. But this is elaborated with a shallow thatched roof stretching from the top of the maypole to the ground so that it looks like a low wigwam with an entrance on one side that can be a couple of feet across and a foot high. The bower is so big, in fact, that you can almost crawl into it. And that is not all. In front of the entrance there's a meticulously tended lawn of green moss on which the bird has carefully arranged his treasures. Glowing red leaves, acorns from a tropical oak, tree fern stems, or iridescent beetle wing covers, each in its own separate pile. Not all the Vogelkopf bowers have the same kind of decoration. Some males clearly prefer particular colours. A bush that has just come into flower may provide a male with a speciality all of his own. Another bird may try to impress with a collection of a particular fungus, and sometimes one so rare that he has to bring it in from over a mile away. Watch the bird when he arrives with his latest trophy, and you'll see that he doesn't just dump it on its appropriate pile, not at all. He puts it down, hops back, and looks at it critically, cocking his head, and then maybe hops forward again, picks it up, and puts it back in a slightly different position. You have to think that he is considering whether or not it is correctly placed from the point of view of its overall decorative effect. Each male, it seems, is trying to impress a female with his own special arrangement, and the male that pleases her most will be the one she chooses to be the father of her chicks. She reaches that decision by making an aesthetic judgment, by choosing the display which pleases her most. To film at a bower, you'll have to build a little hide a tactful distance away. You must get into it before dawn so that the bird doesn't see you arrive. And then you must wait. A male will almost certainly appear and start to rearrange his treasures. Females making their tours of inspection are likely to make only a cursory visit and then leave. But if your sequence is to be complete, you'll need to end it with that last climactic shot in which a female decides that this is the male for her. She makes that clear by flying down to have a close look at the treasures on his lawn. Then the male, visibly thrilled to ecstasy, rushes out of his wigwam and the two mate, surrounded by his jewels. Filming that is a different matter altogether. To succeed, you yourself will have to tour the bowers and make up your own mind as to which is the most attractive. It's rather like going to a flower show and trying to decide which entry is going to win the first prize. If you get it wrong, then you may in fact sit in your hide forever and still not get that last shot. But if you get it right, if you pick the one bower in perhaps a dozen in the forest around you, then you will get that last crucial shot. The fact is that the chances of you doing so are actually quite high. It seems that we and bowerbirds have the same aesthetic sense and preferences, and that thought pleases me no end.
David Attenborough, who's back next week talking about dragons, and also our first science show special on zoos. The first one is Adelaide Zoo. And don't forget Catalyst coming back on air next Thursday at 8 p.m. on ABC One. Production for The Science Show by David Fisher and Charlie McCune. I'm Robin Williams. Oh.
Thank you.